You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 5th of August 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London, with me, Clemency Burton-Hill, and Phil Hahn.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll set the day's news agenda with journalist and author Rachel Shabby. Rachel, what do you have for us today?
Well, this morning we're looking at a massive international diplomatic push to get Egypt to sort it out. We're looking at the rise of militancy in Tunisia, and also we're looking at Israel making all the wrong noises about settlements while peace talks are going on.
Looking forward to that coming up. And marshalling the skies above Burma, we'll unpick the government in Yangon's latest plans to implement the country's first comprehensive aviation policy.
In the last year, you've seen more carriers start to fly into Burma, you know, major carriers from around the world.
Plus, is this the movie that will cement Bollywood in the European market? We'll ask why Chennai Express is carrying the hopes of an entire industry on its shoulders.
All that, plus we'll meet a woman who's written an opera for prehistoric creatures. No, really. We'll check in with our man in Nairobi and we'll play some great music too. All to come in the next hour here on Midori House. Lots to get through this morning, 1 minute past eight here in London, so time first of all to catch up on the headlines from around the world with Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. The United States has extended embassy closures in the Middle East and Africa by a week because of an Al-Qaeda threat that US lawmakers said was the most serious in years. The State Department said 19 embassies and consulates would be closed for the whole week out of an abundance of caution. The US initially closed 21 diplomatic posts for the day on Sunday. Some are reopening today, including Kabul, Baghdad and Algiers. Four new posts in Madagascar, Burundi, Rwanda and Mauritius were added to the closure list for the week. Senator Saxby Chambliss, who's the top Republican on the Senate Intelligence Committee, says the Al-Qaeda threat is the most serious in years. And the chatter among suspected terrorists is reminiscent of what preceded the September the 11th attacks in 2001.
We didn't take heed on 9/11 in the way that we should, but here I think it's very important that we do take the right kind of planning as we come to the close of Ramadan. We know that's always an interesting time for terrorists. We're paying very, very close attention to the chatter that's going on, and this is the most serious threat that I've seen in the last several years.
Egypt's army-installed government says it'll give mediation a chance to resolve the crisis brought on by the overthrow of the Islamist president Mohamed Morsi, but it warned that time was limited. At the same time, a Cairo court announced that the leader of Morsi's Muslim Brotherhood and two other top officials will face trial in 3 weeks' time for crimes including incitement to murder during protests in the days before he was toppled. The National Defence Council, made up of civilians and soldiers, said in a statement it backed mediation that protects the rights of citizens regardless of their affiliations and that spares blood as long as that happens in a defined and limited time. But it didn't specify a deadline. And Egypt's state news agency says two Islamic shrines have been badly damaged by bomb attacks in the Sinai Peninsula, where Islamist militants have stepped up attacks against the state since the army deposed President Morsi. Often dedicated to saints or descendants of the Prophet Muhammad, such shrines are forbidden, according to the puritanical Islamic vision of the militants operating in the area. Militants mostly based in North Sinai have escalated attacks on security forces and other targets since July the 3rd when the army removed President Morsi. The militants have struck on an almost daily basis and killed around three dozen people, many of them members of the security forces. Two soldiers have been killed and eight others wounded in continuing clashes with Islamist militants in Tunisia. The soldiers were killed by a landmine that hit their tank as they patrolled an area close to the Algerian border. It's the same area where militants killed eight soldiers last week in the deadliest attack on Tunisian forces in decades. In the capital, Tunis, one militant was killed and five others arrested after police raided a house where weapons were being hidden. New Zealand's government is attempting to limit the damage from the latest dairy product health scare involving the country's biggest company, Fonterra. Prime Minister John Key has called for more details about the scare as more countries ban imports or recall products contaminated with a bacteria that can cause botulism. Fonterra said the bacteria Clostridium botulinum was caused by a dirty pipe at a processing plant producing whey protein concentrate. Scott Gallagher is from New Zealand's Ministry of Primary Industries.
The safety and well-being of consumers has been at the forefront of the government's mind throughout. Ever since we were notified on Friday afternoon of a food safety issue involving batches of whey protein concentrate that was produced by Fonterra at a single manufacturing plant.
The Israeli government has put 91 Jewish settlements on a national priority funding list, adding six to a roster of dozens of enclaves already eligible for supplemental state cash. At its weekly meeting, the cabinet increased the number of settlements built on land Israel captured in the war in 1967 on a national priority spending list by adding nine while removing three others. The move has angered Palestinians and peace activists. Eitan Wolf is an activist with Peace Now.
This national priority list is a clear indication of the government's plans for the future. So we ask how the government, while encouraging the immigration moving to the settlements, how does it continue to speak of peace? This plan helps and encourages the immigration in building 91 settlements.
Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Barney. It is 6 minutes past the hour here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Uit London, dit is Monocle 24.
Fra London, dit is Monocle 24.
From London,
desde Londres.
Holanda.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Clemency Burton Hill. It's time now for us to set the day's news agenda with the three key stories we'll be keeping our eyes on throughout the day. And today we're joined by Rachel Shabby, a journalist and author of Not the Enemy, Israel's Jews from Arab Lands. Rachel, welcome to the program. Shall we begin with Israel, though?
Let's begin with Israel. As we just heard on the news, it has announced that it is putting more settlements on its national priority map, which allows those settlements, or actually the settlers in those settlements, to receive really very good perks and incentives to live there. And obviously that has angered Palestinians, the international community, and people watching the peace talks that have just reconvened.
That's the point, isn't it? I mean, it would anger and frustrate most international observers and obviously the Palestinians at any point, but it does beg a belief at this particular moment in time that this can have happened right now. What are they playing at? What do they hope to achieve by this? Do they know that they have impunity and basically no one will turn a hair?
I mean, it is quite mocking, isn't it? That's the message that's coming across, that right at the same time that they're convening these peace talks, they're saying, yeah, but you know what? We're not going to do anything about settlements. And this is, the national priority map is actually a really sneaky way to bring in settlements because it looks at all areas over Israel that are in need of development and which the government wants to encourage people to go move there. And the fact that it's included, illegal settlements in the West Bank, along with, little towns on the border of Lebanon inside official Israel, is just a really, really cheeky move and very frustrating at this point in time.
How much of a struggle is this within the Israeli government between more moderates and the more, I guess, national right-wingers in the party?
Well, it's exactly because of that. I mean, obviously, the national right-wingers will be pushing for this and the so-called moderates in the government will be quite pleased that the far right within the government has approved it, because that's the tone that they want to be going in as it is. But it will frustrate people like Tzipi Livni, who's in the opposition, who You know,
who's also the chief negotiator in these discussions.
She's the chief negotiator in the discussions, but she said she's been forced to abstain as opposed to oppose this measure because it actually has bundled together places inside Israel in need of development with places in the illegal settlements in the West Bank. So it's a very kind of blurred, cheeky way of doing this. Israel has always done it this way, but at this point in time, it's particularly insulting.
I mean, there are a few more vexed issues than settlement building. And of course, the issue did halt the last direct talks between the Israelis and the Palestinians back in 2010. Where do you see it going from here?
Well, to be honest, I mean, it's very hard to have any faith in these peace talks, given what the parameters are, given that neither side seems variously able or willing in Israel's case, able in the Palestinian Authority's case, given that they don't represent the entire Palestine, whole chunk of Gaza left out of these peace talks. It's very, very hard to see them going anywhere. And this will confirm the Palestinian suspicion that Israel has historically and continues to use peace talks as a fig leaf to just carry on expanding settlements and pursuing the occupation under the cover of talks.
Rachel, let's head over to Egypt. Last week, we saw the EU's foreign policy chief, Catherine Ashton, visit Mohamed Morsi, the ousted president. Now, two big American hitters are heading over to Egypt later today. Senator McCain and Senator Graham.
Yeah, Senator McCain and Graham are heading over tonight. This comes after the U.S. Deputy Secretary of State William Burns was out in Egypt over the weekend. Also, various EU officials getting involved in the diplomatic push there, as well as Qatari and Emirates representatives. So there seems to be this giant international diplomatic push to get the Muslim Brotherhood and Egypt's military to actually sit down and mediate a way out of this showdown at the moment.
The talks took place amid a lot of tension. Can you give us a sense of the picture in Egypt at the moment?
Yeah, the picture is of a stalemate. I mean, we've had rising rhetoric, I would say, from the Egyptian army that has now labelled the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist and a threat to national security. We're talking about a sit-in in the open air, you know, that's been branded as terrorism. It has been rounding up and arresting various members of the Muslim Brotherhood, including its leaders. The ex-president, Mohamed Morsi, is detained. We don't know where he is. Various other leaders have been arrested. So there is this massive standoff, the Egyptian army threatening to evacuate these continuing sit-ins from the Muslim Brotherhood by force, and the international community obviously now stepping in to try and prevent that happening because it would be very bloody.
Absolutely. Rachel, and let's move on to your final topic. We heard earlier in the newscast with Barney the ongoing crisis in Tunisia.
Yeah, we've seen a rise in militant activity in Tunisia. Now, there has to be some kind of spillover effect going on in the region. This would be a very good time for militants to start operating because of the insecurity and instability. That's the sort of climate that militants tend to, you know, try and take advantage of. And, you know, it's feeding into the whole confusion and argument between the Tunisian Islamist-led government and the opposition. The opposition has always said throughout the coalition's rule that it has not done enough to challenge militancy and Islamist militancy. And now, of course, the opposition is able to say, well, look, we warned you about this. Now look what's going on. We've had some very serious assassinations and now an upsurge in militancy on Tunisia's borders.
It was viewed, of course, Tunisia as a kind of model for the Arab Spring democracy and democratic revolutions that followed in its wake. Is it fair to say that this is the kind of biggest crisis it's faced since January 2011?
It is a really big crisis for Tunisia, and it's a crisis for the entire region. Everybody has pegged, as you say, Tunisia as the one most likely to succeed, the one most likely to have a sort of smooth democratic transition. And certainly all the indicators are still in place to suggest that would be the case. But now it does have this huge challenge to that transition. And a lot of the international community, again, is focusing a lot of effort and attention on Tunisia precisely because of that, precisely because it is the model that everybody wants to succeed.
Rachel, we're going to have to leave it there. Rachel Shabby, journalist and author of Not the Enemy, Israel's Jews from Arab Lands. Many thanks for joining us here on the program.
Thank you.
Coming up next, we'll be heading to Burmese airspace and taking a look at the government's latest plans for a way to control those skies.
Culture on Monocle 24 is untouchable. Go on, just try and do it. Try and grab a handful of the top-grade cultural radio that we're dishing out and see if you can touch it. Well, exactly. Luckily, though, you can feel it. Feel the passion of the unusually button-bright presentation.
It's a fantastic contrast, and it's one of those ones that ask you to look at the brushwork, to look just at the canvas.
Feel the craftsmanship in the breathtaking live Midori House sessions.
You know, I consider myself an entertainer, so I'm really about communication. I'm not really about expressing myself so much as trying to communicate with people and bring them to tears or bring them to laughter or what have you.
Feel the lovingly hand-stitched production, and most of all, feel the love of art.
It's there, and it's true, but it's really only a small part of his work.
Feel the love of fiction, feel the love of film, feel the love of music, feel the love, generally.
It is the most extraordinary collation of works that you would never normally see together.
Why not invite me round? Culture with Robert Bound is a well-behaved house guest and a joy to entertain.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House, where the time here in London is 8:16. Now, it has 25 commercial airports, 7 domestic air carriers, and is a destination for several regional airlines travelling to and from the country. Yet Burma doesn't have a concrete aviation policy.
As the country continues to gently transition from dictatorship to democracy, the controller of the Civil Aviation Authority says that the country needs a strategy to invite foreign carriers into the country and turn it into an aviation hub for travellers in Southeast Asia and beyond.
A policy is currently being drafted and should be ready, authorities say, sometime next year. Well, before we came on air, Monocle's transport editor Tristan McAllister told our news editor Tom Edwards why these early plans by the Burmese authorities are so intriguing.
So, Tristan, let's talk about Burma then. It's kind of intriguing. We gather there's going to be a big new sort of national aviation policy in time for 2014. Just give us a sense of, you know, what the surroundings are, what's the kind of dynamic, you know, in and around Burma, and why this is important at this stage.
Tom, just to sort of lay it out, IATA, or the International Air Travel Association, based in Canada, is sort of an international body that gives mandates in terms of regulatory systems in the world. And IATA has come out saying that Burma needs to have a cohesive aviation policy, and at this point, it doesn't. It has airports, and it has facilities that are run by the government, but that's just about it. It has airlines, but the airlines don't really have an FAA, or they don't have a civil aviation authority really overseeing what they do, at least to the degree that airlines and airport authorities around the world seem to have elsewhere. So that's sort of the basis for this here. But beyond that, it really is the next step for Burma. And some of the authorities there are sort of saying that they're sort of still in kindergarten in terms of where their industry is. So it's definitely the right thing.
And just tell us a little bit about why a national aviation policy helps to deliver some of these things. Because I know there's been some issues about safety, some of the reputations of some of the local carriers not great. We've had some incidents of planes kind of missing runways, this kind of thing. Is that the sort of immediate problem that this kind of policy can address?
Well, not to make light of it, but planes missing runways seems to be a problem that happens all over the world. I think that of course is part of it. I think the airlines there want to be bigger, they want to be better, and they also want to be taken seriously. When you look at how these airlines are perceived outside of the borders of this country, you know, they're not considered the most reliable. They're not considered the most the safest option. And oftentimes, other carriers win out. In the last year, 2 years, you've seen more carriers start to fly into Burma. You know, major carriers from around the world. ANA now has a direct flight from Tokyo. They had one years ago. They've just restarted it. It's a smaller flight, but it means that the business is there, and it means that the opportunity is there. But for these airlines to be taken seriously, they really need to be adhering to a cohesive aviation policy, and I think that will really enable these airlines to do so. A national aviation policy, or sort of aviation framework will enable these airlines to be taken seriously, not only internally, but externally, and then also enable them to open up route options they may not otherwise have because they do adhere to some sort of standard.
And just tell us a little bit, Tristan, about what this kind of policy actually consists of. I mean, what are the actual sort of building blocks that make up a policy of this type? And when do you think we might actually see something?
Well, one of the big things they talk about, Tom, is the idea of traffic growth in Burma and in the region in general. And this is a big theme in terms of what the region is going through. The region, especially Thailand, which is, of course, right next door, is positioning itself behind a multi-billion dollar infrastructure spend. And what that means is that they're really wanting to establish themselves as a hub. And that means traffic growth. And if Burma wants to be a part of that growth, they're going to have to get into some regulatory regimes where people trust that Burma is a safe place to do business, that Burma is the right place to have hubs to provide service to. Beyond that, personnel training, keeping things consistent across airports, and then just a safety framework. You know, this is okay, this is not okay, this is how you handle this sort of a situation, this is not how you handle this sort of a situation, much like the civil aviation authorities around the world do. So it's fairly basic in terms of what it is. It's not sort of like shooting for the stars. It's very much just a basic framework for air travel within the country, which, you know, in a lot of ways I think could lend itself to long-term stability for Burma as, of course, the region grows and politically, economically, however else, Burma has not had the best reputation in the last 10, 15 years. So if it can have a cohesive policy that sort of seeds business, that seeds new opportunities, it can only be a good thing.
And it's interesting you make that point there about stability in the longer term. I mean, do you think these kind of initiatives can deliver that? You obviously understand how sort of integrated transport policy and aviation policy specifically can help countries around the world. We see it in action. Will it deliver for Burma, do you think? Or are there other more immediate problems perhaps they need to tackle, at least in tandem with this kind of initiative?
Well, of course, I think there are other problems they need to tackle, but I think this is a big part of it. What you will see here is the trickle-down possibilities from something like this, where now you have these links out of the country, freight links, whatever else, by air. It means that you can have more manufacturing within the country, which means jobs, which ultimately means social mobility, which means less discontent with the government, however else. So, you know, it could be a very sort of all-encompassing proposition for the country if they do it right.
And just finally, Tristan, I wonder, you mentioned sort of some of the neighboring countries and competition to become something of the next aviation hub, for Southeast Asia. If Burma gets this right, is it realistic to shoot for that kind of recognition, that kind of mantle? Or is it more likely that, for example, Thailand is going to have stolen too much of a march on them to make up?
Well, I think you have to look at these countries in terms of gateways. I don't see Burma being, eclipsing or surpassing Thailand. Thailand has a lot of coastline. Thailand has a lot of land. Thailand also has a huge sort of manufacturing industry and a lot of opportunity. Burma is a long way behind. So I think it's sort of a catch-up game. I think it's also a tandem game when you think about how they could work with regional partners to build strong infrastructure, to use locally competitive advantages, and to really make their mark in the region. And I think they could do this. They're never going to be the power player in the region, but I think they could be a strong part of the equation.
That was our news editor, Tom Edwards, speaking to our transport editor, Tristan McAllister.
Now, Bollywood and many of its subsidiary film industries produces some 800 movies every single year, and with some 14 million Indians going to see one of its many offerings every single day.
But if you think 14 million is a big number, try 3 billion. That's what the industry is worth in US dollars. Analysts, meanwhile, say 2013 is shaping up to be a bumper year for Bollywood. Many attempts have been made to give Indian cinema a firm toehold in foreign markets, and this, the producers hope, will be the movie to do it.
Jab se meri life mein aayi ho, my life fucks.
What?
Fucks.
Same here.
Kyun aayi ho mere paas?
does sound like fun. That was a clip from the forthcoming movie Chennai Express there. Well, it marks the biggest release of Bollywood film outside of Asia in Indian cinema history. 125 cinemas here in the UK are signed up to screen it when it opens to the public this Friday.
To explain this push by Bollywood into the UK and European markets is Ashanti Omkar, an expert on Indian cinema for Cineworld Cinemas and the BBC, among many others. Welcome to the show.
Hello, hello.
I'm really hoping that you're going to give us a little Bollywood spin around Studio One.
With my two left feet, right? I'm doing the light bulbs.
Come on, don't let us down.
The light bulbs, I'm doing them.
Seriously though, I mean, Chennai Express, it looks set to be a huge opening for a Bollywood movie. Yes. Why is this particular film going to have such traction in the UK and European markets, we hope?
One of the main reasons is that Shah Rukh Khan has not had this particular holiday, Eid, for a few years. Salman Khan kind of ruled it for the last few years with films like Bodyguard, and they all broke records. And because everybody's been, well, the Muslims have been fasting through Ramzan, so it's quite nice for them to be able to celebrate Eid with such a release. And this one has all the makings of a blockbuster because it's got Bollywood's leading lady, Deepika Padukone, who is absolutely stunning. Shah Rukh Khan has 3.5 billion fans all over the world. I think that's
quantify that metric?
It's a number that we've been given. I think it's about the fandom of Bollywood. And because Shah Rukh is the one of the leading guys, they actually say that, okay, Bollywood has this many fans all over the world. We are giving these films to all these different territories. Like Chennai Express is going to like Peru this year, you know, and places that it hasn't quite, you know, these sort of films don't usually hit. So yes, it's hard to quantify exactly, but by the number of fans and they gauge this from various metrics, I guess.
What I find quite fascinating is, you know, in Hollywood we have the big name hitters like Angelina, Brad Pitt, yes. You know, all those kind of big names. But in Bollywood, they're really on another level, aren't they? You mentioned Shah Rukh Khan there with some 3.5 billion fans around. You have Amitabh Bachchan,
yes,
you know, the big Aishwarya Rai. These are huge global names.
Yes.
How much of a film's success then is dependent on that one individual's performance?
A lot. These names actually draw people to the cinema. So there are people who will watch any film that Shah Rukh Khan does or Aamir Khan does. That is the height of their stardom, and it's quite amazing to see this kind of traction, because as Cineworld felt, Shah Rukh Khan and Deepika actually turned up, and the entire place was flooded with people. It was absolutely incredible, and they just wanted a glimpse of him, and a few people managed to get some autographs, so they were thrilled.
I'm fascinated by your comment that Shah Rukh gets Eid back this time. Presumably this is, you know, they sort of carve out these territories for themselves, presumably Eid, Diwali, Christmas, yes, these big holidays and New Year. Yeah. And how do they figure out that Shah Rukh gets it one year and Salman gets it the other year? I mean, presumably this is a bitter contest to get those opening weekends.
They seem to play it very amicably between the Khans. So Shah Rukh, Aamir and Salman tend to play it quite amicably, which is very nice. Salman was given Eid a few years ago, and it worked really well for him. And then this year, Salman's filming, so he's had little time to not be doing a film that comes out at the right time. So it actually seems to work out every year, surprisingly. And with Aamir Khan, he's had Christmas quite a lot. Last year, he didn't have Christmas. Talash came out just before Christmas. It wasn't a holiday release, and it was a risk he was taking because he'd been having films like Gajni that were huge hits merely because of the holiday. Holidays are big for Indians to take their families and go and see films.
Now, Shanta, we were saying earlier that this is getting some 125 cinema releases here in the,
yes,
UK. Obviously, these type of films are very popular with Indians and Indians living abroad. But how do you make Bollywood resonate with someone who may not be used to it? You know, your typical, you know, kid down the street.
Right. It's a really tough one. I have to say, over the last 10 years, I've seen a big change where when I say I work with Bollywood, people actually look like they understand what I'm saying, rather than before when I'd get blank looks like, what's Bollywood? So the industry has definitely made its mark worldwide. People know what it is. People understand there's a lot of colour and vibrance to the films. But the truth is, it's mainly Asian audiences that are watching it. The diaspora is so
even
big.
In places like Peru.
In Peru, not so much. You're right. I mean, I'm talking more about the UK and Canada, which are more kind of traditional markets. But the thing is, Indian cinema has been big. Like in Africa, I was brought up in Africa. And, you know, every Saturday we had a Hindi film. And this was the thing to do, is to sit in front of the TV and soak up a little bit of culture. So it is something that resonates. Rajinikanth, for example, has fans as far as Japan. And the Japanese love him. So it's amazing.
It's amazing, too, because some of these films are like 3 hours plus. And in this era where people's attention spans are getting shorter and shorter, I think, fair play, it's wonderful that they can keep people interested that long.
Indeed.
Well, thank you very, very much for joining us indeed. Ashanti Omkar, Indian cinema expert for Cineworld and the BBC, among others.
Thank you very much.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tokyo. Essa é a Monaco 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monaco 24.
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London. Londres.
Esto es Monaco 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Tu vai Monaco, vada se che che che.
From London,
London. London, cara.
De long, de long.
This is Monaco 24.
And in the next half hour of the program, we'll be checking in with one of our correspondents around the world. We'll leaf through the Latin American front pages, and we'll also hear from the French artist who has composed an opera based on the voice of animals that have long left this world.
When I started, I had no idea this project would take me so long. I thought it would be pretty straightforward, actually. You know, I would find scientific data and I would 3D print that, you know, and it would be my sculptures, and I would throw compressed air through these shapes and it would make sound. But actually, it was even more exciting than that.
But first, before all that, here is Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Phil. The United States has extended embassy closures in the Middle East and Africa by a week because of an Al-Qaeda threat that US lawmakers said was the most serious in years. The State Department says 19 embassies and consulates will be closed through Saturday out of an abundance of caution. Egypt's army-installed government says it'll give mediation a chance to resolve the crisis brought on by the overthrow of the Islamist President Mohamed Morsi, but warned that time was limited. At the same time, a Cairo court announced that the leader of Morsi's Muslim Brotherhood and two other top officials will face trial for crimes including incitement to murder during protests in the days before he was toppled. The Israeli government has put 91 Jewish settlements on a national priority funding list, adding 6 to a roster of dozens of enclaves already eligible for supplemental state cash. At its weekly meeting, the Israeli cabinet increased the number of settlements built on land captured in the 1967 war on a national priority spending list by adding 9 while removing 3 others. The King of Morocco has revoked his pardon of a Spanish paedophile after hundreds rioted in front of Parliament on Friday to protest against his release. Daniel Galvanvina was serving a 30-year sentence for raping and filming at least 11 children aged 4 to 15. And New Zealand's largest company and the world's largest dairy exporter has apologised for releasing contaminated whey protein concentrate, which included a bacteria that can cause botulism. Fonterra said the bacteria Clostridium botulinum was caused by a dirty pipe at a processing plant. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Barney Burnham. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Clemency Burton-Hill, and Phil Hahn. For this week's preview of our culture show, we're crossing into a prehistoric realm. We're about to meet a woman who's created an opera from the reconstructed voices of ancient creatures, a mammoth, an ambulocetus, or walking whale, and the rather terrifying-sounding entelodont, or terminator pig, all animals whose sounds haven't been heard for millions of years.
It does sound intriguing. I wonder what a terminator pig sounds like.
Sounds like a Bollywood film in the making, man.
Well, her name is Marguerite Humeau, not the terminator pig. And she's called herself a speculative designer. The opera of prehistoric creatures is a haunting look into our world's ancient past. We're keen to find out more about this fascinating project. Culture producer Katie Bilbao invited Marguerite into Midori House to explain how it all came together.
The idea was to resuscitate their sound by reconstructing their vocal tracts. But the problem was that since the vocal tract, so the lungs, trachea, larynx, vocal cords and resonance cavities are all made of soft tissue, they don't fossilize. So it was an enigma that I had to solve. Unfortunately, I couldn't solve it all with science because it's problematic on the scientific point of view. You know, you're talking about animals which used to live million and million years ago. As a designer, it was really exciting because actually I would have to reconstruct them all. So yeah, I use scientific facts, but also a lot of speculations, stories, rumors, you know, and design, of course. When I started, I had no idea this project would take me so long. I thought it would be pretty straightforward, actually, you know. I would find scientific data and I would 3D print that, you know, and it would be my sculptures and I would throw compressed air through these shapes and it would make sound. But actually, it was even more exciting than that because, again, this data didn't exist, so I would have to reconstruct that completely.
And how did people first react when you told them that this is what you wanted to do?
I mean, it depends on who. A lot of people were actually really excited about it, but didn't really know how I would do that. I started to email a lot of different experts. So maybe now I've been in touch with more than 100 different experts. So paleontologists, explorers, people who are specialized in vocal cords, surgeons, many different people. Some of them were very excited by the project and told me to keep going, you know, even though it would be a tough journey. Some of them said, you know, it's impossible to do that. Again, as a scientist, it's maybe hard to conceive this idea, but as a designer, it's really exciting.
You say you talked to lots of different scientists and historians. What was the process beyond that? What did you have to do to then make these objects?
So there are different parts in the sculptures. There are the resonance cavities, the larynx with vocal cords, then the trachea and the lungs. So four different parts. For the resonance cavities, so I'm talking about the inside of the nose and the mouth of these creatures. It was the first thing I worked on. So for that, I had to gather MRIs from the closest living descendant of each of these animals. So it was already a quest in itself because for the mammoths, I had to find the scans of an Asian elephant. Not so many elephants die every day and not so many actually fit in a scanner as well. So, you know, I had to find this data first. And then I also had to find the skull of the ancestor, so of the extinct creature. And there was then a work of redesign of this MRI data inside of the skull of each of the extinct creatures. So that was the most important part. But then, yes, I had resonance cavities, but, you know, I still didn't have the sound. The sound comes from the vocal cords, which are inside the larynx. The problem with the larynx, and the reason why it took me actually a lot of time to solve this problem, is that there are not so many bones around the larynx, so I really had to make it up in a way, which was actually really interesting, because for the resonance cavities, I was actually quite close to the original creatures, but for the larynx, I also had to accept that this data is just gone, you know, forever, and maybe with design, I could actually redesign something that would actually have exactly the same function, make sound, but not the same shape. So that's what I did. So they are entirely redesigned with acrylic tubes and silicone and latex made from the right thickness and elasticity. And they are stretched. So when the compressed air is actually comes inside the trachea and all the way up to the vocal cords, they start vibrating. And then for the trachea, again, the same. I contacted people who work with large-scale animals like elephants, and they told me about their length and diameter, so I followed their advices. And then for the lungs, I worked with experts in compressed air, and we worked together in order to get the right pattern in terms of breathing, but also roar making, because it's all about the roar. So
it's really complex, isn't it? I wonder, how much do you consider yourself an artist or a designer, and how much a scientist? And how closely do you think those two things are interlinked?
I mean, for me, it's really clear that I got advices from scientists, but I'm not a scientist. And my work is, again, about the border of science. And I believe that science can solve a lot of things, but not everything. And my project is about that. How can I use design when science is not enough?
Thank you. How did you feel when you first heard your creations make a sound?
Actually, it's really great you asked me that because it was very magic, actually. I remember for the mammoth, it was the first animal I reconstructed, and it was like the day before the opening of my graduation show at the RCA. And I had a couple of people helping me because in the last weeks, we were a big team working on that mammoth. And yeah, the first time we actually switched the compressor on and we started to hear the mammoth, I thought, yeah, I'm talking about something supernatural happening. This is really happening. I mean, it's really actually weird and unsettling. I think that was my concern, to create an unsettling experience.
And let's talk about you as a designer, because this isn't just a kind of audio project, is it? I mean, everything I've seen related to it is really visual as well. So the parts of the animals that you see are really beautiful kind of sculptures, really. You've had work published in magazines. There's a book related to it. There's artwork to go with the work you did with James Zhu, who kind of remixed some of the sounds. So how much is it a kind of visual thing for you, and what does it look like?
So the sculptures, for me, they are, I treated them like ghosts. For me, this project is like a film. It's almost like an adventure or science fiction film, but made with design. It's about the experience of a ghost in space and how do you create that. So yeah, the sculptures themselves, I think, are quite beautiful.
Interesting stuff there from Marguerite Humeau speaking to Monocle's Katie Bilboa.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with our daily check-in with one of our correspondents around the globe. And today we are in Nairobi. Don't go anywhere.
Surf's up this summer as Monocle Films follows the wind in search of an under-the-radar beach haven for diehard enthusiasts.
Ericeira is special for its wide array of waves. Beach breaks, point breaks, and reef breaks to suit a range of surfing styles and skill levels, all in a compact span of dramatic coastline. This 8-kilometer stretch of coast was named a World Surfing Reserve in 2011, and the surfers who come here can't stop raving about it.
Catch the wave in Ericeira in the film's menu on monocle.com.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House, where the time is 10:42 in Nairobi. It's 8:42 here in London.
But we are indeed off to Nairobi as we check in with one of our correspondents from around the world. Waiting for us on the line, I hope, is Monocle's correspondent there, Tristan McConnell. Hello,
morning.
Tristan. Morning. You're there. Wonderful stuff. Should we start with the Eastern Congo, or Eastern DR Congo, Democratic Republic of Congo? Tell us more about what's happening there when it comes to the UN peacekeeping mission.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is quite interesting what we're seeing happening in the east of DR Congo with the UN peacekeeping mission there. It's been there for a long time. It's one of the largest in the world. It's almost 20,000 strong at the moment. And it's been relatively ineffectual in terms of actually protecting civilians against, from attacks by a whole kind of host of different militia and rebel groups in the area. So what's happened recently is they've deployed a new force, an additional force of a few thousand African troops, what they're calling an intervention brigade. And what's interesting about this is that they have a kind of mandate to really go on the front foot to enforce peace rather than just to keep it. Now, last week we saw their first kind of operation. It was only a small thing. It was about disarming people within the city of Goma, and really not much happened, but it showed that these guys are on the ground and starting to operate. But the bigger question, I mean, obviously it's going to be significant, it could be significant for the people of Eastern Congo in terms of kind of pacifying an incredibly rest of region. But it also, you know, tells us something about where peacekeeping might be going more generally, because peacekeeping as it currently stands, it was kind of, you know, created as a 20th century kind of product to deal with, you know, state on state fighting and maintaining peace between them. But, you know, the nature of conflict has changed dramatically throughout this century, and peacekeeping has to keep up with it. And perhaps what we're seeing in Congo, although not unprecedented, is a pretty major departure, and it could indicate something about where international peacekeeping is headed for the future.
Well, interesting topic there, Tristan. You mentioned that it was called the Intervention Brigade. Have we noticed the tactics that perhaps the UN is adopting? Have they changed as well?
Well, certainly, if the Intervention Brigade acts in the way that it is permitted to, which is to say, it's allowed to go and actually hunt down militia groups who are threatening the state or threatening civilians. So they're allowed to actually go out looking for these guys and you know, attack and kill and disarm them. And this is not something that we've seen peacekeepers do. I mean, admittedly, they are actually allowed to do this under the current mandate of the larger peacekeeping force, but troop contributing countries are very reticent about taking casualties. So what we tend to see is that when an attack comes on a village or a town or whatever, the UN peacekeepers kind of bunker down and watch and do nothing to protect civilians. And these guys are supposedly going to, you know, go out there and look for the militias and disarm them themselves. And that will be quite a radical departure in terms of peacekeeping. And it really is about, you know, enforcing peace rather than just, you know, making sure that a peace agreement holds. And so this could be quite a change, but it remains to be seen what kind of an appetite the South African, Tanzanian and Malawian authorities who have deployed the troops really do have for, you know, enforcing their mandate to the full.
Justin, let's head south over to Zimbabwe now and the calm that's being urged as Mugabe claims that supermajority and that landslide victory in the poll. Tell us about the story that you've picked up on here.
Well, I think, you know, there's a whole number of interesting things happening surrounding the Zimbabwean elections. But what strikes me as being very clear is the sort of, the dispute between the West and Africa when it comes to this election. So on the one hand, we have, you know, the African Union saying it's credible, although it had some reservations. We have the regional observer body, the SADC, saying that the election was fine as well. We've already had President Zuma in South Africa offering his congratulations.
Well, the SADC, sorry to jump in there, said it was free, but they didn't say it was fair. So how credible can that be?
Yeah, I mean, this is bringing on to something that else I wanted to point out, which is a sort of tendency that I've noticed in a few elections recently, which is here in Africa to sort of say, well, you know, if it's peaceful and we maintain stability, it'll do. So an election doesn't really need to be sort of, you know, completely free and fair in the way that we might, you know, hope it would be. And it doesn't even have to necessarily reflect fully the legitimate will of the people. All that seems to really matter in an election like Zimbabwe, and you could make this case in Kenya as well, where we had recent elections, but the overriding thing that counts is that we maintain the peace, maintain the stability. And that, I think, is quite a worrying trend because it, you know, it acts against sort of democratic accountability, which is what these elections are really all about. And I think that is a sort of trend that we're starting to see here. And it's reflected in these comments from the SADC, from even the African Union, who say, yes, we have reservations, but, you know, elections aren't perfect, so let's just move on. Don't rock the boat. Let's just push ahead with the government and everyone please stay peaceful. As if that is the, you know, the only thing that counts in an election. And I think that's worrying. And the fact that we've got, you know, I mean, let's face it, the Western observers were not allowed to actually attend the elections, but it's not just the US, the UK and the EU who are raising concerns. You know, the largest domestic election observer body, which is called the Zimbabwe Election Support Network, they had 7,000 observers on the ground, which is sort of 10 times the number of any other group. And they said that there were serious concerns, including something like a million voters prevented from voting on the day, and that was, and this is not insignificant, that was in, you know, urban areas which are traditionally the stronghold of the opposition. So it's not just the West who's got issues with this election. And I think it remains to be seen what, you know, really what happens next, whether, you know, MDC supporters who are clearly going to be disappointed with this, whether they will, you know, follow their leaders' advice, which is we're going to go to the court and stay calm, or whether they'll take to the streets, also how, you know, the government chooses to react to that. And then, you know, on the broader picture, you know, what is the West going to do here? You say an election is not, you know, it's not credible, you have serious concerns. Well, you know, how then do you choose to go forward with President Mugabe at the helm of Zimbabwe for another 5 years?
Absolutely, Tristan. It is a developing story that we will continue to watch here on Monocle 24, along, of course, with your expertise. Tristan McConnell, our man in Nairobi, many thanks for joining us here on the program.
And now, before our Brazilian newspaper review, we have music from the so-called Brazilian King of Tacky. His name is Wando, and his classic song, Fogo e Paixão, gained cult status in the country. Let's have a listen.
Você é luz, é raio, estrela e luar. Me põe na boca o mel.
That was Fogo e Paixão by Wando, expertly chosen for us by our in-house Brazilian resident, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Fernando, why did you want to hear that song?
It's funny because, you know, even though he's the so-called King of Tacky, he's actually quite cool nowadays. A lot of people are re-recording the song. Actually, I've been to a concert by lovely Gabi Amarantos. She's like a new Brazilian singer that everybody likes it. And she played that song and I said, you know what, I think Wando deserves to be played on Monaco 24.
What's behind his new renaissance?
It's, I don't know, because I think he's so honest, you know, it's a very romantic, he's very romantic. For example, I'm just going to read a very quick line of that song. You're my light, my thunder, my star, my moon. You're my yes and never my no. You're fire and I'm passion. I mean,
W.H. Auden, eat your heart out.
It's just amazing. And I have to say, every time he plays, a lot of women, they throw their underwear on stage. I mean,
really?
It became a well-known thing for Wando.
But you weren't throwing your underwear at Gabi Amarantos last week.
Not yet.
Just joking.
Fernando.
We've got a pay-per-view with Fernando coming up now. Maybe some underwear will be thrown if the stories get excited enough.
Who knows? Let's keep our underwear on.
Shall we keep it clean this morning?
Shall we begin, though, Fernando, with the Folha de São Paulo newspaper?
Let's start with Folha de São Paulo. And there's an interesting picture here of President of Bolivia, Evo Morales, that he was giving a speech to some leftist leaders in Brazil. But the interesting thing why I chose this story is that a lot of Brazilians, they complain about the imperialism attitudes here in Europe and the US, like the way you were treated in immigration borders. But then actually, there's been quite a serious problems for illegal Bolivian immigrants in Brazil. There's a big community and actually they don't have good conditions of life there. You know, they earn very below the minimum wage. And it's interesting, the government is trying to deal with this situation because Brazil now is becoming a country that is receiving more immigrants. So the government tried to give some amnesty to some of them. But I think we still have to do much more, actually, to fix the problem. And I think we can set even an example. But
in general, though, what sort of life do immigrants in Brazil have? What kind of conditions do they face?
Quite bad. And actually, the Bolivian community, they especially work in the clothing industry in São Paulo. And I mean, I've seen pictures. There's actually a store in Folha de São Paulo where they live, you know, like in a room, there's like 10 Bolivians living there. So, I mean, it is quite sad, you know, and it's interesting to see that Evo Morales and our president, they have quite a good relationship. So I do think the government is trying to deal with that problem, especially like with amnesty and other issues. So I think it's an interesting
story. Let's stay with the Folha de São Paulo. An interesting story here, and it's all about an albino alligator. What can you tell us about
this?
Exactly.
Well, that's a kind of a cute story for the weekend. As you can see, there's a picture here of the alligator, and he's got a problem on his back. So basically, it was a big feature because there's a place in São Paulo called Aquário de São Paulo, where they treat animals with special needs. And it's funny because they profile the animals who live there, including this lovely albino alligator. His name is Jorginho. And he's got fruits every morning and he's got a massage every day because of a problem on his back. And there's another one called, there's a snake called Bebel. She's like an anaconda. You know, anacondas are huge. I think the biggest snakes in the world. But, you know, she has problems eating. So she usually could eat a cow, but even to eat a duck now, she has some problems. So it's quite a little story about, and actually this space has been there for 8 years and they have 300 animals. So in case if you find a reptile in horrible conditions, you can just take there.
You know where to take it, all
exactly.
The way to Sao Paulo.
Some good news.
Wherever you are in the world. Underneath that rather fetching picture of the albino alligator is a picture of Cesar Cielo. He's just triumphed at the Swimming World Championships in Barcelona.
Exactly.
Bit of a Brazilian hero. But you're quite good at swimming, aren't you?
We
generally
are.
Not I mean, you yourself. But, I mean, maybe you are.
I'm actually good in swimming. I'm joking.
You'd hope that the Brazilians would be good at swimming, the amount of time you all seem to spend on the beach. But maybe I'm stereotyping.
We're not very well known for, I mean, people usually associate us with football or volleyball, but actually we do have a very good historic. We have iconic players such as Gustavo Borges, Fernando Scherer, and now Cesar Cielo even won, I believe he won a gold medal in this last year's Olympics. And I'm sure he's going to win again in Rio,
and
if it's not too old.
Fernando, let's head over to the old Globo newspaper. A stunning picture on the cover of what looks like an Amazon tribe, and it's taken by quite a well-known iconic Brazilian photographer.
Exactly. So actually it's a very beautiful story from the Globo, and they're going to run for the whole of the week. You know, Sebastião Salgado is one of our most famous photographers, and he did this with a journalist, Miriam Leitão. They did a special story on this tribe in the Amazon called Ava. And it's interesting to talk about Ava because they were contacted for the first time in 1979. And most of them don't speak Portuguese because a lot of indigenous communities in Brazil, they're actually becoming quite, they're living in cities sometimes. But this tribe is very, I don't know if I can say wild. I mean, they don't have too much contact. And the problem is there's a lot of people in their land for profitable reasons. So again, there's been some discussion, the government this week, saying that asking non-indigenous people to leave their land. So they're trying to delimit this land for the tribe Ava. So I think that's quite a beautiful story.
I have to say, there's the most staggering exhibition of Sebastião Salgado in London at the moment at the Natural History Museum.
I've seen that. Beautiful,
an exhibition called Genesis. And I think it's amazing how powerful a photograph like that can be in terms of raising that sort of awareness, but also just from a purely anthropological and aesthetic point of view, that exhibition is a must-see.
It is a lovely exhibition.
Thank you, Fernando. Sadly, that's all we have time for today on Midori House. Thanks very much to our producer, Daphne Denis, our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Zoe Tennant, and our studio manager, Alex Funnell. Up next after the news, Andrew Tuck is here with The Urbanist. Dominic Reynolds and Guy Delaunay will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Clemency Burton-Hill.
And me, Phil Hahn, it's goodbye and thanks very much for listening. Goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.